Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 106. Today, the Amateur Traveler goes to New Mexico.
I got my bags packed, I'm on a roll. I'm heading out there, and I'm ready to go. I'm looking real good in my passport photo.
Oh, no.
15-hour flight, oh, I don't think I'll ever be coming home. You know I love it. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. The interview is going to be a little longer today, so I'm only going to do one news story. And since one of the four blogs for our guest is The Roving Gastronome, I'm going to do an article that I saw on Forbes magazine on the top 10 cities worldwide for foodies. And so their list from Forbes magazine, and I'm interested to see what you think about this, is New York City, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Paris, Bologna, Italy, Singapore, Palermo, Sicily, Barcelona, London, and Sydney, Australia. What's your top 10? The link to that article can be found in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome on the show Zora O'Neill, who has come to talk about New Mexico. And Zora, you've just recently written a book about New Mexico.
I have. I finished it up in the springtime, and it's coming out at the end of September. So it's called Moon, New Mexico. It's published by Avalon Travel Publishing, and it's a guide to the whole state.
Great. And welcome to the show, first.
Thanks. Thanks, Chris.
Now, before we get very far, we should establish what country New Mexico is in, because I know of at least one story where somebody who's a senator from New Mexico was told by some government officials that they couldn't do that because they were applying for something from outside the United States. It is, as I recall, in the United States.
Oh, yes. This is a totally classic phenomenon. The senator is not alone. In fact, the magazine New Mexico that comes out every couple of months, has its back page is devoted entirely to people's anecdotes about being told that New Mexico is not a state, and nobody really understands. So yes, it is part of the 50 United States. It gained its statehood in 1912, and to make sure that's clear, you'll notice on the license plates in New Mexico, they say New Mexico, USA on them, which is
oh,
seems a little defensive to me, but maybe it's necessary.
Interesting. So if we go to New Mexico, can you kind of lay out the state for us, first of all, in terms of how it breaks down and then where we should spend our time sort of on a grand scale, and then we'll get into more details?
Well, sure. Okay, sort of imagine dead center in the middle of the state. State is big and square, smack between the top half of Texas and Arizona. So it's sort of similar in size to Arizona. Right in the middle of the state, a little bit north, is Albuquerque, which is the biggest city. It's almost a million people now, I guess, and that is also where the main airport is, and that's where everybody flies into, basically, when they're starting a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And then
we turn left at Albuquerque, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly, and you want to do a ritual turning left when you get out of the airport. And after that, most people head up to Santa Fe, which is the state capital, and it's a lot smaller. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. It's the main tourist destination. And then a little bit north of Santa Fe is Taos. That's about an hour's drive. Santa Fe is about an hour from Albuquerque. Taos is about another hour north of Santa Fe.
Okay.
And Taos is another big destination for people who want to go Julia Roberts spotting and things like that. So those are the sort of the main destinations, and I think a lot of people who come to New Mexico, and I don't blame them at all, spend most of their time between Albuquerque and Taos. And they're totally welcome to. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the state. But then if you head straight south from Albuquerque, you get almost to the border with Mexico. You get to the border with Texas, very close to El Paso, and Mexico is Las Cruces, which is sort of the second biggest city in the state, and it's where New Mexico State University is, and they have the Chili Pepper Institute, and they sort of have their own thing going on down there.
The Chili Pepper Institute. Now, we're not going to let you get away with that one and not explain it.
Oh, sure. Well,
promoting the use of chili peppers? Or
well, New Mexico State University has a huge agriculture department.
Okay.
And the Rio Grande Basin down there, sort of the valley all alongside the Rio Grande down there, is prime farmland for New Mexico chiles. And the New Mexico chili is like an essential part of the New Mexican cuisine. And basically, if you have managed to get your hands on New Mexico chili pepper in, say, neighboring states of Texas or Arizona, it probably came from right around Las Cruces. So there's a team of experts down there in Las Cruces who are devoted to maximizing the yield of chili plants and arcane things of that nature.
Now, when we're talking about chili peppers and New Mexico, it seems like we should pause here for a second. Now, I'm from California, and I love Mexican food, and I love spicy food. And I have been told if I go to New Mexico, if I go to New Mexico, that I should order mild.
Yeah.
That you have a very different standard
of
hot.
California is a totally different thing from New Mexican. It's funny because in New Mexico, everybody says, oh, I'm going out for Mexican, and they really mean New Mexican, but nobody really makes that distinction. So that's an important thing when you're sort of understanding what sort of restaurant you're getting into. Up until maybe the last 10 years, regional Mexican food from Mexico was almost unheard of. So everything is by default Mexican. But what that means is New Mexican, which is sort of a lot of familiar shapes like burritos and enchiladas. But covered with either red or green New Mexican chile, which is not meat sauce, like there's no meat in it. Sometimes there's a little meat in the red, actually. But it is either sort of a really hot green. It has an incredibly distinctive flavor. Nothing tastes like it. Sometimes if you read recipes, they say to substitute Anaheim chilies, and those are not quite as hot and not quite as flavorful. So there's green, and that's sort of the fresh, vegetably tasting stuff almost. And then there's red chili, which looks like you would sort of associate with sort of Texas-style chili. Mm-hmm. But like I said, rarely any meat in it, and it's just pure heat. It's so, so good and so addictive. Anybody who lives in New Mexico and then moves away, that's like the single biggest tragedy is giving up that stuff. So, and yeah, it's really hot. It really depends on the season. So some people say, oh, green chili is always hotter than red or vice versa, but it really just depends on the season and how the yield is that year.
Hmm.
Let me just add a terrible, let me just to illustrate how hot things can get on the chili front in New Mexico. I remember one year when I was a kid, one year the green chili crop was so hot that I remember we were all eating it. It wasn't stopping us, but it was so hot it was making our lips crack.
Ouch.
And it was so, I remember my mom had this sort of permanent sort of raw spot on her bottom lip, but it was so good we couldn't stop eating it. So it's that kind of, when I say it's addictive, it's kind of like that.
Well, I was just aware of the heat of New Mexican food because we have a New Mexican style restaurant here left at Albuquerque.
Oh, you do. Oh,
but I'm sure it's toned down.
I'm sure it's toned down. Well, you know, if they get the chili, that's the authentic thing.
Well, they tend to use more like a habanero chili, for instance.
So, exactly.
But so I know someone who ordered, for instance, habanero poppers, and I happen to like jalapeno poppers, but they were just miserable the next day. And the way they put it, and there's just no way to say this delicately, they said it burned going in.
Yeah.
And continued to burn there. So on its passage well, out as well. But anyway.
Well, anyway, I could talk about the food in New Mexico forever, so maybe we should move on to other topics.
Well, is there anything we do want to, as we're talking about food, we've talked about pain thresholds here, but is there anything else we should look at if we're, especially for someone coming from out of state, that we should be aware of that, one, we could actually be able to take, and two, that really that's a quintessential New Mexican meal, or that's something you can't leave New Mexico without trying?
All right, I'll describe sort of the standard. This is my standard order when I go into places. And I'll describe the way the plate looks and everything. Everything at a classic New Mexican restaurant is served on that super heavy white porcelain because it goes in the oven.
Okay.
So a waitress will come out and say, this plate is really hot. And she'll, like, slam this super heavy porcelain dish down on your table. And if it's a really standard New Mexican place, it'll have like either a formica tabletop or a glass tabletop. And there's something about the sound of that porcelain plate on a glass tabletop. And on that plate, sort of the standard thing I get is chicken enchiladas with green. Never really mind what the menu says. Those are your options. And you always say sort of the thing you want with green or red. And if you don't say, the waitress will always ask you. So I'll say I have chicken enchiladas with green, and a lot of places will do flat enchiladas rather than rolled enchiladas,
okay,
which really just means a stack of, there's a corn tortilla, some shredded chicken, cheese, corn tortilla, shredded chicken, cheese, so you get this little layered thing, which you can't really see because it's totally, totally smothered in green chili sauce, which is kind of, it's a little bit chunky. But it's all this sort of uniform green color that looks like, kind of like if you left Kermit out in the sun for a long time. It's not an appealing color, yet we learned to love it. And then sprinkled on top of that is a bunch of sort of melted cheddar cheese, usually. And then on the side, there's always beans and rice. And the rice is always sort of Spanish rice, sort of cooked with a little bit of tomato and a little bit of celery sometimes. So it's that sort of bland pinkish color. I know it's sounding terrible, but it's delicious. And then you get a side of beans, which are refried beans, which if it's a good place, they use lard, so they have super extra flavor. And then there's always this token pile of shredded lettuce and chopped up tomatoes, which really you don't really eat anyway. So there's that. And then the waitress comes back with the crowning glory of New Mexico cuisine, which is a big basket of sopapillas. And sopapillas, to my knowledge, I don't think you really see them anywhere outside of New Mexico. Maybe in Arizona a little. But they're basically little bits of fried dough that look like little pillows. They puff up. So they're these beautiful, beautiful little square pillows. And those things are the key. They often serve them for dessert, which they're great for. You put honey on them. But they're also the key to, like, surviving the chili, because the starch and the grease in the sopapillas kind of spreads and dissolves the chili oil in your mouth.
Okay.
So you can take a bite of the green chili enchiladas, and if it's hit you a little too hard, you can take a bite of the sopapilla, maybe have a little sip of beer, but you don't want to go for the water because
right,
that just makes things worse.
Newbie move, yes.
And the other thing I should warn people about is you can order sour cream on the side, but everybody thinks that's Texan, and so you'll kind of, they can tell you're from out of state if you order sour cream on the side.
Okay.
But, yeah, that's the classic scenario. The first time you see it, you'll be like, huh, I don't know, not so appetizing, but it'll grow on you.
Okay. Moving on from food, then.
Okay, if we have to.
We were doing a overview of the state, I think, before we took our foods exit there.
Oh, right. After the minor distraction. Let's see.
Well, okay, we had to make sure we covered food. There was no way we were going to get by without doing it.
When I was thinking about this interview, I was thinking, like, okay, what are the main attractions in New Mexico? Well, there's the food, and there's the landscape, and there's the culture. And then I realized, like, normally you would mention the landscape and the culture first and then get to the food. But I'm glad we got the food out of the way first. That's really one of the selling points. So we're in Las Cruces, which is the big city at the southern border of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole southern half, not the whole half, but essentially the southern half of the state is a giant desert, which is not like a big sand dune desert, but is more sort of scrub desert. There's yucca plants and roadrunners and lots of yucca, lots and lots of yucca. It doesn't seem like the most hospitable area, especially if you've been up in the mountains in the northern half of the state. But it's kind of neat to go down there just because you can drive and drive through the desert, and then you show up and you hit the Rio Grande, and everything is suddenly lush, and there are these huge towering cottonwoods and shade and moisture and tons of birds, and it's just so neat to see the contrast because it's that much more dramatic if you've been out in the flatlands.
Mm-hmm.
Las Cruces doesn't get a lot of tourists, although in the south, one of the main attractions down there is Carlsbad Caverns,
right,
which is fantastic. I have to admit, I had never been to Carlsbad Caverns before I wrote this book. Because if you're living up in Albuquerque, you're kind of like, oh, it's so far. Why would I drive down there? And it's filled with tourists. I am so, so, so glad I went down there. It's far from everywhere, but it is so worth the trip. It's amazing. And also down there, sort of just east of Las Cruces, about an hour's drive, is White Sands National Monument,
okay,
which is also an incredibly surreal piece of landscape. So that part of the state, if you're sort of flipping through a guidebook, it doesn't get nearly as much space devoted to it as the whole Albuquerque-Santa Fe Taos zone, but you can make an amazing trip with Las Cruces and Carlsbad Caverns and White Sands.
And with Carlsbad, just before we leave that, did you or do you recommend, I know in the evening you can see the bats leaving the cave. And
oh,
that a
yeah.
lot of people talk about going to the cave. And then the other thing that's memorable for them is that exodus of the great clouds of bats from the cave at dusk.
Yeah, which unfortunately I was not there for. They're
okay.
only there in the summertime.
Oh, okay.
I think that's right. There was definitely some reason they were not around when I was there. We went in the middle of winter, which was actually really cool because we were there, I think it was more like November, and there was no one there because there's no one on vacation really at that time yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of cool because it was a little chilly outside, but going down into the cave was actually relatively warm. I think it's 68 or 70 degrees down in the cave all the time.
Interesting.
I was not expecting to go from like sunny desert outside where it was actually a bit chilly and then down into the caves and actually have it be warm. By the same token, if you go in the summer when it's, you know, 100 degrees outside and you go down in the caves, it's fantastic, I would imagine. And you get to see the bats. I did see they have a special amphitheater kind of thing set up outside the mouth of the cave so you can sort of sit there in comfort and watch them all come out. And they come from deep, deep, deep down in the caves. In fact, the bats are the reason they discover the caves in the first place.
Right.
The guy who was poking around was wondering where they could all be coming from.
Okay. Anything else in the Las Cruces area?
Let's see. Well, you sort of start hopping like, oh, and then from there you can go there and there. Down in the southwest corner of the state, Carlsbad and White Sands. And actually, I have to give a little side plug to Roswell while we're down in the south.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because, see, like, Roswell is featured on the side of moving vans, basically, and everybody kind of thinks of it just as the place where the UFO landed, which, don't get me wrong, they're capitalizing on that right and left. It's kind of hilarious. Even the little street lamps in the downtown area are sort of fixed up to look like little alien heads, which is very cute. But the reason I liked Roswell is there is a fantastic contemporary art museum there. There's an art fellowship program in Roswell,
okay,
a residency program, basically, where artists are invited down to do painting, sculpture, whatever. They're given housing and stipend, and it's been going on for decades now. And in concert with that, the Anderson Museum of Contemporary Art has been founded, and it has little samples of all the resident artists' work. And some of these people who have been through this program are extremely famous, or famous if you know contemporary art, I guess. If I start dropping names and people will be like, yeah, that's great. people like Luis Jimenez, who is a really well-known Southwestern sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away last year, actually. He was building a huge sculpture for the Denver airport, which I think they recently put in place.
Oh, okay.
So he's really well known. There are a couple other people who've been through the program who are very well known in the art world. So you can see their stuff, but you can also see a huge range of artwork. And it's great because it's kind of crammed in the space. I mean, there's this endless supply of artwork coming every year. There's more. And everybody who goes through the program donates a couple pieces. So the place I can see has been getting more and more crowded. It's not arranged chronologically, really. It is a little bit, I guess, or by genre. So it can seem a little chaotic, but it's kind of just neat to see the juxtapositions of things that you wouldn't see in a more formal gallery space. And a lot of the stuff is products of these people's time in New Mexico. So you get to see various representations of the state or just various commentaries on New Mexico and environmental issues sort of pop to mind a lot. I don't know. It's a really fascinating thing in Roswell that I was not expecting at all. It was really great to see, in addition to all the UFO business. But before that, I was about to skip over to the southwest part of the state. So from Las Cruces, you can drive east and see Carlsbad and White Sands and Roswell. You can head west, and sort of northwest from there is Silver City, which is another town that has developed really nicely in recent decades and has its own nice little art scene, and it's kind of up in the mountains, and it's at the base of the, sort of at the border of the Gila Wilderness area.
Okay.
Which is the largest protected wilderness area in the state, and it's huge. It's, if you look at a map, it takes up a really significant portion of the southwestern corner of the state.
Okay.
Silver City is sort of the jumping off point for going into the Gila on river rafting expeditions, on hiking trips, on backpacking trips. And Silver City is also the base for an annual bike race that is really cool. It's called the Tour de Gila. It's a big training ground for the Tour de France, actually, because it's at super high altitude.
Oh, okay.
There, so a lot of people come up there to kind of train, and the roads are really winding. It's where you sort of sharpen your mountain biking strategy. So it's kind of fun because it brings all kinds of people from all over the world into town every year. And they've kind of got a fun scene.
Now, are a lot of tourists surprised when they find out that New Mexico has mountains? It just doesn't seem like that's the part that gets shown on TV or whatever.
That is a very good point. And it's kind of hilarious because, in fact, the main places people go in New Mexico are in the mountains.
Right.
Santa Fe, Taos, and Albuquerque. Well, Albuquerque is at the base of a big mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
And Santa Fe and Taos are both up in the mountains. I do often wonder how many people sort of get there and they're like, hey, wait a minute. this was not shown in the Bugs Bunny cartoon. And the other thing, sort of, that's kind of the hilarious adjustment, but the real kind of brutal adjustment that people often don't account for is the altitude,
mm-hmm.
which can be, if you come from sea level, and it happens to me all the time when I go to visit, I lie on my mom's couch and I'm like, oh no, I can't do anything today. It takes like 3 days for me to get acclimated, but I think I'm also a little lazier than most people when I go there. Yeah, the altitude can be pretty intense. Albuquerque is at like 6,500 feet, which is not so much, but then the mountains right there are 10,000 feet. So if you get a little carried away and you're like, oh, I want to drive up to the crest and take in the view and ride the tram or whatever, like, don't do that your first day, because you will be at best totally exhausted and miserable, or at worst, like, actually physically ill. And I have met people who kind of overdo it and then spend like days sitting in their hotel rooms drinking water and feeling kind of queasy. So,
mm-hmm.
which is no way to spend your vacation. But if you plan for it, you're fine. Like, if you spend the first couple days not doing anything too strenuous, then it's no big deal at all. But yeah, the mountain desert juxtaposition is a great selling point, but it is kind of funny that people don't often have that in their heads.
Sure. So, New Mexico, your top three things to see.
Oh, man.
I know. It's a terribly unfair question, but...
It's totally awful because I always want to champion the underdog and be like, but nobody goes to Truth or Consequences, okay. And that place is totally
Well, let's
cool,
do
but...
the top three places that people go, and then your three favorite that people don't know about.
Okay. Top three, I mean, all of Santa Fe is gorgeous, and you have to go to Santa Fe and see it and sort of marvel at it. It's the second oldest city in the United States after St. Augustine, Florida. And
I did not know that.
It's just incredible because, in a way, it's partially manufactured. Like in the early part of the 20th century, the city decided they needed some tourism money because the railroad had started going through Albuquerque and no one was coming to Santa Fe anymore. So they, in a way, invented Santa Fe style, which is this very distinctive architecture, which is kind of a little bit based on the American Indian Pueblo architecture from sort of the adobe building. And so in a way, it's kind of concocted, but it's also completely unique, and it's just beautiful. Like, sunset in Santa Fe is really amazing, and there are great, great, great things to eat in Santa Fe and cool concerts to see and fabulous art to see. It's just a really thriving scene. And then, of course, people have to see Taos. I mean, it's also kind of beautiful, and it's kind of interesting because if you describe it on paper, Taos seems like it's just a miniature version of Santa Fe. It's like, oh, it's in the mountains. There are galleries. Yeah, the light is beautiful. You can go skiing or hiking. But the two places have a really different feel, and Taos feels really, really, if you spend a little time there, you really get a sense of, like, being at the very farthest fringe of civilization. Like, you're out there. I mean, you can check your internet and so on, but you're really, really out there, and you feel very, very small in comparison to the landscape, and that's an incredible feeling.
Okay.
Which you can find that in a lot of places in New Mexico, just because you can really get away from people so easily. The population density is so light. And then I would say... Slot three is always difficult. I'm kind of saving Albuquerque as my underdog favorite place because everybody comes into Albuquerque and flies in and leaves immediately. And understandably, for many decades, completely understandable that they did that. It is, on the surface, not an attractive place, especially if you compare it with Santa Fe. But it's funny because I grew up in Albuquerque, and of course I hated it. It was totally boring, and I couldn't wait to leave. And
I grew up there, too. No, just a different city.
Right, I know. When I started going back in my 20s, I was like, hey, wait a minute. There are really cool bands here, and downtown there are all these great bars. And Albuquerque has been a really good – there's a lot of crazy growth going on in Albuquerque that is a little unsavory, but – the core of the city has developed so nicely. Like, what downtown, which used to be a total wasteland, has turned into a really fun place to hang out, and people actually live there as well. It's like a neat sort of new urbanist redone downtown. And there's just a lot of sort of grassroots stuff there. The band The Shins came from Albuquerque.
Okay.
People like them.
Now, there is one festival that Albuquerque is known for.
The Balloon Festival, Fiesta, of course.
And is that, I look at the pictures from that and I think, gee, that seems like one of those things you've got to see before you die. Would I be disappointed if I went? Would it be even more grand than I expect?
It is pretty neat. I mean, I'm a little jaded because when I was little, like, I sort of hated the Balloon Fiesta because it involved waking up really, really, really early. So it was not my scene at all. And even now as an adult, I kind of have to talk myself into it. But I'm always really glad I went because, yeah, you too, you get up super early and you have to get on the best way. You don't want to drive down there on your own because it's mayhem. The parking, they've gotten more organized. But if you drive there in your own car early in the morning for the mass ascension, it's like dark and no one knows where you're going and you're like driving through ditches and... So you want to go to one of the little park and ride stations somewhere in the city.
Okay.
And I don't know if they still do this, but when I was little, they just bundled everybody on school buses, which seemed, you know, so rotten to be spending your Saturday morning, like, on a school bus in the dark, just like you did the rest of the winter. So you sort of trundle out, bounce out there on your school bus, and yeah, it's dark, and there are a lot of people who are sort of running around doing things and ignoring you. Like, there's no show for the visitors, which is what's really interesting. It's like you wander around and you just kind of look at people doing their things with the balloons, which involves, you know, if you've ever been up close to a hot air balloon, mm-hmm. like, it involves really high powered flames.
Right. Very loud. Really,
right. Loud and hot and kind of intense, and lots of people running around and yanking on ropes. And it is an amazing sight when sort of dawn breaks and all these things just sort of drift up into the sky. The effect on the crowd is kind of like a slow motion version of watching fireworks, you know, how everybody goes, ooh, ah. It's kind of like that, like spread over 45 minutes, because you'll be sort of looking over in one direction and you'll be like, oh my gosh, there goes the Planner's Peanut guy. And everybody goes, yay, and kind of claps. And then you look over here and there's this huge rainbow colored one going up and everybody claps. And it's kind of a neat, I mean, it is something everybody should see. And again, the setting is beautiful. And there's funnel cake, you know, if you get hungry. So all your bases are covered.
There you go. We're doing our top threes. I think we got two okay. from the...
All right. So Santa Fe Taos and Balloon Fiesta. I think okay. that's fair as top three. And then sort of the top three places that people don't really go, but they should, which are because they're very strangely representative of the rest of New Mexico. Well, I would say the rest of Albuquerque, because people hardly ever see it. Although, frankly, you can kind of skip Old Town. I mean, I hate to say that because I know there are many people who are running wonderful businesses in Old Town. Don't skip it. Just don't peg your whole visit to Albuquerque on Old Town. Albuquerque is not Old Town. Like, you can easily go there and be like, oh my God, how many chili pepper t-shirts can a person buy? Like, it's like gift shoppy saturation down there.
Okay.
So you can go there. It's scenic. That's nice. But the whole rest of the city is, it's just developing so nicely. If you're an outdoorsy person at all, you will love it. There's a beautiful bike path and jogging path all along the Rio Grande, where you can ride for miles along the river, like all under the cottonwoods. It's beautiful. Or you can go up to the mountains, up to the Sandia Mountains really easily. That takes about half an hour to get up there into the foothills. You can go mountain biking. And there's even a little skiing in the winter. The ski area there is really basic, but pretty cheap and fun. And I don't know, it's just kind of nice, especially if you've been up in the northern part in Santa Fe, which, you know, people take themselves pretty seriously in Santa Fe. And I love Santa Fe, but there's a little bit of an attitude sometimes, which can get a little precious. And you come back to Albuquerque and you're like, ah, real people. Oh, you know, people who work for a living instead of, I don't know what, instead of sitting around in expensive cowboy boots. So it just has a really good feel. And it warms my heart when I talk to the occasional person who's like, oh, yeah, I just went to Albuquerque for the weekend, and who knew? There was so much there. I would say that's my number one underdog destination in New Mexico.
Okay.
Truth or Consequences is really bizarre and really cool now. That place was another place when I was growing up that was like total wasteland. You couldn't even get anything. You couldn't even, like, get a good hamburger there. I still have a horrible memory of, like, desperately pulling off of I-25 to get something to eat and being, like, horrified. But now, somehow, I don't know how word got out, but, like, in the last 10 years, maybe even less, it has become sort of this strange refuge for coastal hipsters who have sold everything and moved to Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And so you've got the guy running the antique toy shop, and you've got the woman running the cool vintage store, and you've got tons of people running really funky galleries. You've got the guy running the fair trade, organic, super duper fresh roasted coffee place. And then you've got a million random people walking around who love to talk. And you've also got hot springs, because before Truth or Consequences was called Truth or Consequences, It was called Hot Springs, New Mexico, and had this tourism industry sort of built on coming to visit the healing waters. And basically all of downtown is built on these like hot aquifer thing. And every other motel has little hot water beds. And they got really nasty, and kind of the Hot Springs tourism market, you know, went bust in the early 30s and 40s. People were no longer taking the waters the way they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have kind of revived that and have built very attractive hotels around these places. It's just a surprisingly lovely place. There's an especially neat set of hot springs on the river there. The place is called River Bend Hot Springs. It's kind of a little inexpensive hotel, hostel kind of setup. And all their hot springs are also right on the river that goes through there, which is great. You're sort of outside and there's running water and you're in the hot tub, and very, very pleasant.
Okay.
And then the most obscure underdog place, there are a million other things. The more I think, the more I'm like, oh, people should go there. I mean, that's why I wrote the book. So anyway, the really obscure underdog place is Pie Town, which, like Truth or Consequences, you look on the map and you're like, what? You know, why is a place named Pie Town? And it was named Pie Town because the main east-west highway, like well before Route 66, there was a pretty big highway going through there to California. And Route 66 came and it was no longer popular. Pie Town was on this older highway, and it's right on the Continental Divide. And it's right where, so it's like kind of like a natural stopping point. And some guy used to sell pies there.
Huh. Okay.
And that stopped, and decades went by until, I don't know, late 90s maybe. Some woman came through Pie Town and was like, what? They're not selling pies in Pie Town anymore? This is terrible. So she took it upon herself to open a new pie cafe in Pie Town and kind of kickstarted it again. And I mean, I don't want to oversell it. There's nothing there. Like, there's this woman's pie bakery, and there's another pie serving diner down the road, and that's basically it. But the cool thing is, if you drive west to Pie Town from I-25, you pass the Very Large Array, which is this huge radio telescope installation in the movie Contact with Jodie Foster.
Right.
It was all shot there, and in the movie, they're like sending messages to space beings or something, but that's not really what they do. They're just giant, super, super powerful telescopes that look like gigantic satellite dishes. So it's kind of surreal. You're like driving across the plains and you're like, oh, there's a little antelope and there's a little, oh, and there is the most gigantic piece of machinery you've ever seen. And there's like 30 of them. So you kind of drive through this weird space zone. And then you get to Pie Town, and you basically just have to decide which place you want to eat your pie at, which, you know, you could eat at both of them. They're both delicious. And once a year, they have the Pie Town Pie Festival. I think that's near the end of the summer. That's when people really turn out. Pie Town is also interesting because it's in Catrone County, which is kind of famous as being the county in New Mexico where all landowners are required by law to carry guns.
Okay.
So, yeah, a family friend of ours bought land down there, and he was like, whoa, not really my scene, but okay. So, you know, he adapted pretty easily and put the gun rack in the back of his truck, and now fits right in. But
okay, that's not near Lincoln County and the Lincoln County Cattle Wars.
Right, it's, you know, very close by, so
okay.
Just Lincoln County has become a little more, you know, a little more tourist-friendly. Catrone County, not tourist-unfriendly. It just is not oriented toward that. People are still very libertarian. They've passed some interesting laws trying to keep the federal government from controlling public lands down there and things like that.
So interesting.
There's sort of a big legal issue in Catrone County, which is kind of manifested in people really walking around with six shooters on their hips. Like, I'm not kidding. I was sitting at the Daily Pie Cafe eating my like wonderful berry pie, and the screen door goes, slams, and in walks the oldest man. He sort of shuffles in, and he's wearing, like, you know, the kind of jeans that, I don't know, people wear them, and you can tell they've been worn for about 30 days straight, and they have that kind of sheen to them, and he's got, like, a big bandolier of bullets around him. And this gigantic gun in a holster on his hip, and everybody, like, you know, the waitress is like, howdy, Floyd. And everybody at the counter is like, howdy. And just sits down and has pie, and everybody is totally fine with that, which I love that about New Mexico, that you can be in Santa Fe at a fantastic art opening, and then you can drive a couple hours, and you can be in Pie Town, and there's just so much there, so much range.
Well, I think I've kept you about twice as long as we promised. As we wrap this up, the biggest surprise that you had as you were researching this book?
Oh, man. It was probably Floyd in Pie Town. I mean, people tell me about that, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, it's still the Wild West of New Mexico. But it wasn't until I saw Floyd with my very own eyes that I was like, oh, it's all true. That's right. It warms my heart.
Any final comments for us?
Aside from generally encouraging people to go there and checking out the elevation before they go.
Okay.
It's a fantastic place to visit because you just feel like you're really on the fringe in so many different ways, like culturally, geographically, you're really on the edge of a lot of things, and it's really fascinating. So.
Well, that's great.
I haven't even talked about like 2/3 of the state.
Yeah, I know. It's a big state. The person who did Rhode Island last week had it easier, but.
I think so. All she has to say is like coffee, milk, and I don't know what else.
We talked about that, yes. So if you're interested in knowing more about, Lincoln County, Google Billy the Kid, and that'll surprise you if you don't know that story.
Yeah.
And then if you're interested in more about New Mexico, the book again is The Moon Handbook on New Mexico.
Yes.
And our guest has been Zora O'Neill.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for coming.
Oh, actually, you know what I should add?
Okay.
There's also a separate book in the Moon Guidebook series that I wrote that came out last spring that's just, it's Moon.
Just on Pie Town?
Just on Pie Town. It's amazing. Rich with history. 700 pages. No, Moon, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Taos.
Okay.
And so that's sort of dedicated just to those, you know, hot areas that people go to with some suggested drives for all around there. So it actually covers a pretty big chunk. So it can be really thorough and get Moon, New Mexico when it comes out in a couple of weeks. Or if you think you're just going to take a shorter getaway and stick to the cities, you can check out the more specialized Moon, Santa Fe, Taos, and Albuquerque.
Okay. And I'll put links to both of those in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. And Zora, thanks so much for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great.
I would normally have the internet resources section of the show today, but it's already going along, so we're going to skip that and go directly into news from the community. I got an email this week from Greg, which I'd like to share. Greg says, just wanted to say thank you for all your wonderful travel info. I'm sure with this show, when it all sounds so good, you can bet a lot of work went into creating it. The only thing I would change is the irritating song for the show. It is really hokey, and I just don't think that all with all the other quality and great energy that goes into the show, that you want a tune that is so hokey. Greg did go on to volunteer to donate if I was looking for money to support the show, and I thanked Greg, but I'm not currently looking for that. I will be looking or continuing to look for advertisers to support the show, but really just don't want to head the donation route. I'd rather you spent your money on travel and then come talk about it. In terms of the hokey song of the show, I've had mixed feedback on that. Greg's, I think, is one of the first ones that's not liked it, or that has written that has not liked it, and others have written saying where can they get the whole version of the song because they like it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up a survey on amateurtraveler.com. I just put up a post for a listener survey to try and get some demographic information as well as find out what people like and don't like about the show. It's about time I did that again. It's been a long time since I did it. That will also help me because in 2 weeks I'm going down to the Podcast and New Media Expo, and I'm planning on sitting down with Tim Street from French Made TV for about an hour of marketing consulting, and I thought it would be helpful if I had some demographic information before I sat down with Tim. So if you could fill out that survey, it's only 10 questions, won't even ask you how much you make, like other surveys do, which always kind of annoys me. So take a look at that at amateurtraveler.com or the link from the iTunes enhanced version of the show. Love to find out what you think about the theme song, about the news section, about the community section, about the interviews, all sorts of questions in there to try and figure out what's working for you and what's not and how long you've listened to the show and various things like that. So check that out. If you have a comment for the show, like Greg did, feel free to send me an email at host@amateurtraveler.com or look out the many ways to contact me at amateurtraveler.com/contact. You can also send me a voicemail by calling 408-8494-POD or by Skyping Chris Twice. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Oh, and now just for you, Greg, I'm going to play the hokey theme song.
One more cathedral, I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
The best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show and Limelight.